Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm, yada, 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 founder of interview site Mixergy. Hey, I like to get really personal in my interviews. And the guest that you're about to meet is the kind of guy who gets super personal with people in private. And I had him on to do an interview a few months ago. We were supposed to talk about the company that he started, the Iron Yard. And instead, we ended up talking about alcoholism, suicide, super, super personal stuff. And we never got to this phenomenal company that he founded and sold.
And so, because that was more interesting, but who knows?
You think suicide is more interesting?
Oh, yeah. It's life and death. Company.
I do, too. and at the same time, I remember saying to you, I would give up my marriage for a successful company. I would even give up my life for it, let's be honest. And then I walked away being embarrassed by what I said. I said, oh, I love my wife. Olivia and I are super tight. And then I go and I do this jerky thing. Why did I say it? And I realized there's an element of truth in it. And as much as I love her, I want to leave a legacy that comes from the company. Anyway, I got super honest in there. You got incredibly open in it. And then we booked this interview to do the follow-up, to talk about the Iron Yard, and you didn't show up. And then we booked it again, and you didn't show up. And then you booked it again, and then you didn't show up. And my people on my team are saying to me, Andrew, this is what happens when you push people to talk too personal. Not everyone wants to do this. Not everyone wants to do this in public. And I said, no, I think my radar, I think I'm good at getting how people feel. And I got how John Saddington felt. He was okay with that. We're going to ask him whether he was or not and what was going on when he didn't show up. But I will say this to you guys. John Saddington is one of my favorite entrepreneurs because he is so open about what life is like here that he's not giving you the fake story. If you have any doubt about it, please go back and listen to the previous interview, which he now thinks is maybe better than this interview. And we didn't even do this interview. Give this a chance, John. Who knows? But that's where we talked about the really openness of what it's like to be an entrepreneur and what it's like, frankly, to be John, not just any entrepreneur, but someone with his chemistry, with his biology, and what was going on in his life. In this interview, though, John Saddington is back. We're going to talk about his company, the one that feels like ancient history to him, but I'm fascinated by. It's called The Iron Yard. And the reason I'm fascinated by it is because there was a period there where I was noticing that lots of entrepreneurs throughout the, not lots, there were a handful of them throughout the country who were creating these coding schools, in-person boot camps, really putting developers through the paces and then helping them get jobs. And they were producing lots of revenue and profits. And in John's case with the Iron Yard, actually selling out. And so I invited him here to talk about how he did it and what happened there to the whole industry. And we're going to learn about that business, and we're maybe even going to find out a little bit about his latest company, which is called Yen.io. It's a cryptocurrency social platform. John is a prolific entrepreneur, and this is his latest company. I think this one might be the biggest of them all. And we can do it thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first is giving my office right here. It's called Regis. Oh, I got this great story. In fact, two stories that will show you why I freaking love Regis, really, in dollars and cents. And the second one is hosting my website. It's called HostGator. But I'll tell you about the sponsors later. John, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, man. We'll see if the Encore performance is up to snuff.
Did you not show up because we were a little personal and you were a little embarrassed?
No, I had to bail from the other two because I was flying internationally. And then the other one, to be truly frank, I was just not in a good place. I may not even be in a good place right now.
What do you mean? What's going on mentally?
I mean, just building a company is really fucking hard.
And so are you doubting yourself and thinking, who am I to come on Mixergy and talk about my successes?
Actually, no. I literally was in such a foul mood that I thought I would probably just lose my shit, and that would really, really bad.
When you're in a foul mood, what's up? This is where I get carried away with, like, not the story that we're here to talk about, but when you're in a foul mood, what goes on with you?
Well, I actually am pretty bad mood right now, but one of my professional coaches has a saying, and he says, you can't think your way out of going insane. And that's what I try to do, especially as an engineer. So I literally just walked out of my house, smoked some cannabis, and then walked the block like three or four times. And I think I feel a little bit better.
You know what? I'm so glad that you're saying this on the record, because We've had guests cancel on us in the past. And when I was getting started, I always thought it's something about me. I'm too small for them to care about. They don't care enough about my site. And so they're going to do something that's more important. And what I discovered, especially after talking to some people who've canceled on me over the years, it's usually what they're going through that's keeping them from being on here. Most it's usually likely. Some big issue. Like this one entrepreneur was nearly going bankrupt. And how could he come and do this interview and feel good about what I was going to interview him about when that's what's going on with him? So I feel like Yen is doing well. Why you're doing well? What's going on?
I think for anyone who's building, has built companies before, or just been in that type of situation, it's just really, there are a thousand things that you're trying to do.
That's not a John Saddington answer. You're talking very generically and talking broadly. There's something specific that's you. What's going on?
I had a fight with my co-founder this morning.
Co-founder is your brother.
Yeah. Co-founder is my brother. And
about?
Oh God, it's always like the smallest thing, right? It's always like the smallest thing that's more representative of a much larger, like perhaps philosophical or fundamental issue. But we sent out an investor update like we do religiously every first of the week of every month. And he didn't like one particular thing that I included. But I had asked him the night before, actually asked all the team, like, hey, take a look at the update, let me know, or forever hold your peace. It's going to go out to these very important people in our lives. So, everyone checked the box, everyone gave the emoji in Slack, right? Thumbs up, whatever, it looks good. But at 4 a.m. this morning, my brother texted me like, why'd you include that one thing? And I was like, God damn it. Like fucking fuck. Like, and then it just was like, it all went downhill from there.
Why did that bother you that he asked about that one thing? There's a deeper issue.
Oh, well, obviously, but it was because I had asked for everyone's feedback and assuming that everyone read it. And he had signed off on it, like with the emoji that he had read it, but clearly he had not, which like I totally understand. But then I think it's representative of a larger, I think just communication pattern, even with folks that for a long time, when you're in the crucible of building a company, it forces you to actually really examine at a very tactical level, like who the people you're working with are and how they behave. And despite the fact that I've known my brother for, nearly four decades, it's just like tripping me out that I find things that I really like, really fucking annoy me. And that's just the reality. So, you walk through it, you work through it and you figure things out, but at 4 a.m, man, I was just like, man, this is the first and the last thing that I want to like encounter when I wake up. I at least want to hit my coffee first.
John, I don't know if you're into it. I don't know if the audience is into it, but I feel like I would love to do a monthly interview with you from now until Yen sold or goes public just to go.
That'd be cool. That'd be fun.
I'm going to put it out to the audience, guys. Give me feedback on that. I've never done that, but I'm so freaking fascinated by John that I'm going to go on sidetracks here. All right. Your brother is your twin brother, right?
Yeah.
The two of you guys were adopted.
You're right. From South Korea.
Like you miss your parents? Does that
actually? We actually met our parents. We actually, my brother hired a private investigator, and searched for maybe a decade and a half. Finally found them in the late 2000s, or 2000, like 8, 9, or something. And we ended up doing a trip and meeting our birth mom. And so we're technically, I guess, the industry the other term is in reunion, and it was crazy. I mean, it was absolutely nuts. Probably way too much to explain or try to share here, but that was a huge part, I think, of my brother's experience and kind of filled a lot of gaps for me.
Screw it. Guys, John, I will, if you're up for it, I will just go into like your birth family, your whole thing once a month, even when you're feeling foul. In fact, especially when you're in a foul mood, we just get on and we record.
I'll just text you like, Andrew, I'm in such a shitty mood. We should just hit the record button.
Right. Or we just schedule it once a month and we let it happen however it is. I got to do that with you. All right. I'm going to continue here because I want to get into your entrepreneurial experience and get into the Iron Yard. What you told our producer a long, long time ago when we did the pre-interview was you said, hey, look, a defining moment for me as an entrepreneur came in the second grade with Ninja Stars. What happened with Ninja Stars?
So I'm sure a lot of people have a very similar story, but so we had this like kind of class-wide, school-wide fair. And the idea was to apply some of the things we were learning in class. And in this particular case, we were learning like macro, microeconomics, and more specifically, supply and demand, which is fascinating because I think most adults even understand supply and demand. But anyway, so they challenged each student like to create their own shop. I was like, great. And I thought, like, I was big into origami stars, origami particularly, but then ninja stars were awesome. And so I was like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a ninja star store. And so I spent all week building, putting these stars together. And if you remember, you buy the pack and there's a lot of colors, but then there's only one silver and one gold. And so I kind of realized I could price those a little higher. And this was a huge, huge defining moment in my life. So I walk in Friday morning. It's a big all day event. And I'm putting on my poster that I made at home, like John's Ninja Star Store, you know, something super creative, right? And, I was told, like, if you realize that you're selling your product faster because of the demand, then you should increase the price to manage supply. And I was like, and I just kept, like, telling myself, okay, manage supply. And he's just a small, like, second grade, like, Asian kid, right? If you can imagine just like carrying this box of ninja stars in a shoe box and, you know, manage the supply, like, super weird. But so I set up, and long story short, I start selling out immediately, and I forget everything that I was taught. I was just so enraptured with the idea that my peers would purchase something that I made. And I can clearly remember standing there seeing my peers throw these ninja stars at each other. And I said, and not in these words, because obviously a second grader, but essentially, this is what I want to do for the rest of my fucking life. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to build stuff and see other people use it, because that is so satisfying. That was it.
Was selling important to you, or was it just have people interact with what you made?
I almost knew that you would ask that. That's a really great question. And something actually I really struggle with is pricing. I think most entrepreneurs, most businesses struggle with this, but I think in particular, I struggle with this because I think price sometimes can get in the way of the product and becomes like the defining factor rather than the product itself, which is partly the reason why I spent so much time in the open source community, because I love building and then giving away for free. Problems is you can't really make a good living off of that long term. So I had to like have a really good dose of reality. So I started building like services and products on top of open source projects to make a little bit of a living. And that actually worked, but yeah, that's a really great question. I still struggle with that today.
You know what? There's a great HBO movie called Barbarians at the Gate about a wonderful book about the buyout of Nabisco and the fight over who gets to do it. And the CEO of Nabisco at the time said the reason he wanted to buy Nabisco is so he had something to sell. He said, "Hell, Charlie, all I am is a salesman. People buy you when they buy what you're selling. And I feel that too, that you could like me enough by taking something that I give you. But if you buy it from me. You love the thing that I created." And there's a sense of validation that only comes when they take the money out of their pockets and give it to me. And to me, that's significant. It sounds like to you that wasn't. And that's why open source still appealed.
Yeah. Or maybe it's an abstraction that I've never quite understood, right? And I might be pretty dense in a number of different areas, but I just felt like the point of building wasn't to extract value from the person who was ultimately going to use it. The point of building was because you wanted to build it. And you saw that there was a need in the world, and most usually like your own. So you start with yourself. But this was the first time where I built something specifically for someone else, and they loved it. And the transaction aside was almost like secondary, but just seeing it, I can just see it in my mind's eye right now. It was earth shattering for me. I was like, this is the most enjoyable thing I think I've ever done in my life. And I still get a kick out of that.
You said to our producer, the story of Engine Yard started in May 2012 when you first joined as a mentor and advisor. Was this with Techstars?
Actually, Techstars was definitely a part of that story. We know Brad Feld and the folks at Foundry Group, and we essentially borrowed the Techstars model to build an accelerator within in the Southeast, kind of the first of its kind.
That you helped create?
Well, I became a mentor of that program, okay. Which then began a relationship with the founder of the accelerator. And then we decided the opportunity was the Iron Yard, which is the education code school. So we built that together.
How did you know that that was the opportunity of building this school for developers?
That was actually pretty, easy to identify, because once we started funding companies through the accelerator program, a typical like 12-week batch, whatever cohort model, these organizations needed software developers. And that was a big problem, and especially in the Southeast, high quality candidates. And we were all technical, or at least the folks on the advisory team and the founding team of the accelerator. So we were like, well, shit, what if we were to train these people ourselves and then essentially move them right into our portfolio companies? And we thought that was like pretty brilliant. It turns out like that wasn't probably as brilliant, but it ended up working because the model of retail education had just come into vogue. And we said, wow, this could be really it. Our first prototypes worked out really well. We're revenue generating and revenue positive from day one. And so we just thought, man, I think this actually scale. So we eventually ended up putting pause on the accelerator and then going full-time to the education side.
How'd you find the other three co-founders?
Peter Bart was really kind of the center spoke. He was our CEO, and he knew Eric and Mason and myself. So he kind of corralled all four of us together into a workable team.
Why four co-founders? Why didn't you just say, I've got this idea? And this is one of my problems. I have an idea. I just want to go and do it. And I don't want other people around. I'm almost like want to just be in a room by myself as an artist and creator. And that's a problem. Why did you go to four though?
Actually, I would challenge you when you said that's a problem. I don't think that's a problem. It's just a different way of doing it. Clearly, you've been successful. Clearly, there are enough examples of solo founders. Four was actually a lot. And I think one of the biggest problems was that you never had a very, you could get into a tie in terms of major decision making. And so if I were to ever do, well, I am continuing to build companies, but I will never have an even number of co-founders. It just logistically, tactically, strategically is trouble outside of two, which is kind of breaks the rule. But four was a lot for sure. No question about it.
Okay. And so you ended up with four. Each one of you, though, was technical. I think each one of you could really teach. Am I right?
Yes, right.
Okay. And you decided who was actually going to go do the teaching and who was going to do the selling.
Yeah. So we divided the labor that way. Actually, one of them was not as technical. So he wouldn't have been able to teach as well, but he was more on the operation side anyway and was more naturally gravitated that way. And then one of the four created the core curriculum and built the prototypes for the teaching. And the rest of it just started to scale. And so after the first two prototypes, we opened up two campuses simultaneously.
You know, let's pause for a second. I want to make sure that I understand this. To me, the beautiful thing about this was these programs would sell for $10,000 to $20,000.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
How much did you guys charge?
I think sub 10 the beginning to start, and then we think we scaled to like 12 or 14.
Okay. And then all they needed was space, and office space to teach is not hard to come by, right?
Nope. Not if you're an incredible negotiator like Peter was.
Yeah. I want to find out about that. And how many students did you get in your first program?
The first prototypes were like 8, 9.
And over how long were you going to teach?
12-week period.
12-week period, 8, 9 people, each paying, let's say, $7,000. Is that right?
Well, let's just say 10. Yeah, 10,000 to make it easy.
Okay, so $80,000, which is really a nice start to this. The curriculum I'm always fascinated by. How did you figure out what you were going to teach and know that it was going to work out?
I can't remember exactly how we decided, but we used a number of different data sources. And of course, most all of us were in kind of the technical scene. So we need the popular languages, JavaScript, Ruby on Rails, iOS. So that's really essentially what we started with. Hacker News and like, oh God, I'm having a brain fart, but another does an annual developer survey of the top languages. And so you can just use the pull from that.
And so you were going to teach one language per program. And mm-hmm. How did you know what you were going to teach within that language?
Oh God.
What you were going to teach. What I'm trying to get at was, did you look at the other programs that were doing this and say, here's how they're teaching it, here's how they're breaking things down? Or did you look at some of the accredited universities and say, this is how they're doing it, or a book? Was there some source that would tell you this is what works for teaching this language?
Yeah, I think one of the exciting things, well, we definitely did our research. I think every good company should, to see how some of their competitors, especially the larger quote unquote incumbents in the space, like the General Assemblies of the world, were doing it. Although the space was very, very nascent and new. But I think the thing that really attracted me to the project to begin with was the fact that there was this really unique opportunity to kind of recreate pedagogy and education as a whole, and to really rethink how do you teach incredibly difficult technical skills to someone who may not have any technical background, which means that you need to be much more familiar with a wide array of skills and industries and technologies, liberal arts, to be able to communicate effectively to these folks.
Did you have any teaching experience before?
Not officially, no.
But anyone on the team have any teaching experience?
Maybe one of them had done a nonprofit teaching.
Okay. So basically what you had was an understanding of the languages and opinions about how to teach, and you were willing to go in there and teach based on what you thought was true and adjust as you learned from what was working. Am I right?
That would be a really good way of putting it. Another way of putting it is we don't had any fucking idea what we're doing and we're just making it up.
Okay. All right. You know what?
And it worked, though.
You said you negotiated.
The thing we all knew. Was that we would take a super pragmatic approach.
Sorry, we lost your audio a little bit. Yeah, what'd you do?
We would take a super pragmatic approach to it instead of a theoretical or computer science-y approach. And that ended up working out really well.
Okay, let me talk about my first sponsor and then go back in there. My first sponsor is a company called Regis. John, I told people that I get more productive when I come into a Regis office as opposed to working from home. The other day I worked from home, I ate too much. I got too distracted. I finally just got out of there. What I don't ever talk about is all the other ways that Regis helps me. And I rent office space from Regis, which means that I've got my office here. It's all mine, but also we have shared reception area, shared kitchen area, couches and lounges, and any Regis in the world I can go and hang out in. But on Monday of this week, I was hanging out at another Regis office that happens to have an outdoor courtyard because I wanted to work outside. And a box came into the office with virtual reality headset because Facebook will not ship internationally. If I ever need to send VR headset from Facebook to someone in Australia or even in Canada, what I'll do is I'll have it delivered here and then I'll ship it out. But I can't deal with shipping things out. I start to procrastinate over that. It doesn't go out. So I messaged the receptionist here and I said, can you please ship it? Here's the address. And she said, yes. I said, find the cheapest price. So she priced it for me, and FedEx was $100 more than the US Post Office for shipping out this VR headset. And I said, great, go with the US Post Office. And she did, and I'm going to be charged whatever the amount is. It's going to be added to my rent. And the beautiful thing about it is she saved me $100 and the work. And this is one of many, many ways that Regis helps me. This is one. Let me give you another one. You guys might notice that my mic is in a different position today because we're trying to improve the audio quality. We actually bought John a microphone and sent it to him. There it is. Going to hold it up. Because we want to take the audio quality more seriously here. But the thing on the mic wasn't positioned right. Every time I tried to adjust it, it would just flop down. I needed some tools to fix it. I don't have tools. When I went to the receptionist, I said, do you happen to have a plier? She goes, yeah, I got plier, I got wrenches, I got whatever you need. She brought this little office kit. She gave it to me. I adjusted my mic. This thing is not dropping off anymore. And now hopefully I'm going to sound a lot better for people. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, yes, Regis gives you office space at a really good price. Number two, what Regis does is they give you that reception area with which will greet your guests, lounge area so you can sit, kitchen and all that so you can eat healthy instead of snacking at home. And it does get you more productive on a day-to-day basis. But when you need something taken care of, there's a group of people here who are here to help you. And if you're looking for office space, or frankly, if you're looking to be more productive, if you've got a remote team and you've got someone who you want to make more productive, go check out Regis. You don't have to commit to anything. All you have to do is go to regis.com/mixergy and schedule a meeting to check out office space. And if you don't like the first space you see, and frankly, some of their spaces I don't love, just different vibe, different people in there, ask to see another and another until you find one that jives with you or you realize that Regis is not for you. I remember when I went to Washington, D.C., I asked a salesperson to just give me a tour of the whole D.C. area. I want to know, do I like Arlington? Do I like this other state? Do I like Washington, D.C. And it turned out I like an office in the heart of Washington, D.C. And that's where they gave me office space. So you do want to investigate with them. Go to Regis.com/Mixergy or just email me and my team, contact@Mixergy.com. We'll introduce you to our person over there. John, let's talk about your negotiation for space. What did you do?
I'm actually not an incredible negotiator, so I leave most of that to folks who are a little bit more equipped. But
sounds like you had a good deal, though.
Peter Bart is an incredible negotiator, and so he was able to actually finagle some incredibly low price per square foot, kind of all inclusive deals in the 12 or 13 different states that we actually have ended up opening in kind of retail locations into. So, I mean, we got some. Oh God, I promise I'd never tell anyone this. So like we had like a downtown Atlanta in like this old, not Macy's building, Sears Roebuck building. It was a historical building. It was fucking awesome. Like beautiful. I had actually had a photographer take some pictures of my wife and I in that building. It was so amazing. And just straight downtown right next to the, like the MART, one of the MARTA stations. It was like unbelievable, right next to underground Atlanta. And so I think we negotiated something to like, oh God, was it like $8 a square foot? It was something un-fucking real. And we had some existing relationships, but I don't know. There's some people who are just so good at negotiating and figuring out like how to leverage and apply social pressure that it just baffles me. But that's an example of just like incredible price per square foot that we got.
And that is the benefit of having partners. I'm trying to look at it. I do kind of see it. But it's hard to find a lot of photos because it's shut down. And I'll ask you later about what happened that shut it down. Boy, the inside of the space did look good. Your job in there was not to negotiate real estate. Your job was to do what?
I was brought in to do a number of things. I hired the first 50 or 60 folks. So I knew how to scale a company, scale organizationally and culturally, and then also be an evangelist and to help expand geographically. So essentially my role was expansion, if I were to put it into a singular word. I think what was, you didn't ask this question, but I always have to mention it because it was kind of a big deal for me at the time, but it was my first like co-founding role that was non-technical, which was very uncomfortable for me. I'm very comfortable, much more comfortable building software, writing code, spending hours in front of the computer and just not getting up and sipping like sparkling water, than spending all my time working with humans. And so that was uncomfortable, but also an incredible amount of growth for me personally and professionally. And I'm grateful for it because goddamn, like I learned so much. It was awesome.
And so why did you push yourself to do something you were uncomfortable with? You told our producer about this. I was going to bring it up because it seemed like it was such a painful thing for you to decide to do. Why did you decide that you wanted to do it?
I do. I love education. I have a master's in education. My twin brother has a master's in education.
I get it. I mean, why did you want to do the human HR stuff? Well, why did you want to build the team instead of doing the stuff that made you feel more comfortable?
Because I wanted to grow. Because I love education. I love learning new things. And I have this fascination with leadership. Not because I'm necessarily a great leader, but I think it's just fascinating. I think when you watch human beings commit their very lives to other people, if that doesn't just make you pause for a moment, right? And then ask like the really like difficult questions, but important questions of why in the fuck would you follow that person? Like, or listen to that person or like dedicate your life to that person. And most people immediately think of like political movements, religious movements, but no, I'm talking about jobs. I'm talking about like the fact that you've committed a big portion of your life to the very job that you're sitting in right now. Maybe
into the vision of the founder, right? Into the person who like, you're going to be working with and being influenced by on a daily basis.
Like that's crazy, right? But I've always been fascinated, which means I always wanted to see if I could be a good leader. I always felt like maybe I could be, but I thought an area of growth for me in particular was spending more time on the people operations. And figuring out how to hire folks at scale, like in a fast growing context. And that, I've really never had done those things. I'd done all that technically, but so I felt like if I was going to be, if I had a shot at becoming a good leader, a good, not a great leader, but just a good leader, then I probably needed to know how to do that. And so this was a great opportunity to do
that. What did you learn about doing that well?
Oh, shit. Well, that assumes that I did it well, right? Where do you even start? I think one of the biggest takeaways was I realized I'm not naturally equipped to lead people. That there are some skills that are just, that take an immense amount of time to acquire and to learn and to hone and to craft and to execute well against. And I think I'm committed to try to continue to grow in those areas. There are also some things that I learned that I absolutely hate about people management. I absolutely hate about hiring, and I hate about firing. All very fundamental things to build.
Did you have any insight into why people would follow you? Why would somebody come and work for your vision that you were using to hire, that you were using to keep people on board?
That's a great question. Oftentimes I would ask myself, I would actually wonder, why the hell did you just say yes? but it has been relayed to me in conversation with good colleagues and some of the folks I've hired, because I've actually asked, like, yeah, you accept the role 6 months ago, you've been with me for a year or whatever. Like, you know, at that point you get really comfortable with them and you feel really good about asking like personal questions. So I've asked like, why did you choose to work not just here,
yeah,
but with me, right, as one of the founders? And I got a ton of different answers, but a pattern emerged where they just thought that I was earnest and that I was honest, that I had made a commitment to a vision that was bigger than myself, and I was honest about it. I was transparent. I didn't conflate anything. I didn't inflate anything. I didn't try to lie about what I thought the real potential was. I was very honest and straightforward. And they said they really appreciated that they felt like, so here was the one thing that, here's the one huge like data point that kept getting brought up. So when I would hire people, and I hired a lot of people, which meant I did hundreds of interviews over the first like 18 months. But so I would say, I love, you know, you're talking through the interview and you kind of get to that point in the interview where you know this is a candidate and they really like you, you really like them. But I would be very honest and say, hey, the goal here is not that you would retire here. The goal here is not that you would even necessarily stay more than 2, 3, 4 years, maybe max. The goal here is that you would help me achieve these outcomes, right? Both business and then within the sector and space, and that you might leave with these skills. And I just put it so plain, like,
what right are the skills that they would leave with?
You know, a lot of them had never been in a high growth startup. So learning how to scale a high growth startup, many of them had never actually formally taught, but a lot of them loved education. So I had these kind of a banquet of opportunities of new experiences to offer them. In exchange, I said, if you get those and then I get this, I get your time, right? Your allegiance, at least for a period of time, not forever. But the point of that is all of them, many of them would come back and say, I loved how you told me that it was okay for me to quit, that you didn't expect me to be here for my entire life. And I just thought, wow, like, that's so weird, because like no employer would ever expect you to stay anywhere permanently. Like, that should be table stakes, right? I don't know. It was just for whatever reason, that was very novel. And so they said, like, we would follow you for that period of time.
So it wasn't follow me forever, follow me for that period of time. You've also told our producer, look, one of the reasons why I was able to do this well is because my team gave me the confidence. They trusted me to figure this out.
Yeah, they took a big risk, I would say. And to that, I'm super grateful. Again, because I'd never really scaled an organization that fast, and not used my technical skills primarily as a driver. So I'm super grateful. And they gave me the bandwidth to fuck up. And fuck up I did.
What's a big fuck up?
Oh God. Like where do you even start?
Is there one that eats you up that makes you feel like, ah, oh, I'm terrible at this because of that one incident?
Oh man. So we made some really rough hires in the very beginning. Just like any startup does. And so as the kind of the person that was sourcing, recruiting, hiring, and then also firing, it was kind of me end to end. Not that they didn't participate, obviously, but ultimately it was my responsibility. So everything came back down to the quality of our instructors, you know, and I took some big bets on some folks who were young and who had clearly technical skills, and were passionate about education, but had never taught formally. So, and you can imagine like this could either ended up being really amazing or like, oh my God, like this was terrible. And so some of those ended up in some litigation with some of the students, or at least a threat to go toward lawsuits.
Because they weren't getting the education that they wanted.
Yeah. And the instructors were just,
because you hired someone who wasn't capable enough yet.
Yeah, it was much less about the results, but more about like interpersonal skills. Like these people were so young, some of them, that like they were just, they would say some super stupid stuff, like from the podium, like, and just like HR violations everywhere. And you're just like, God damn. Like,
oh wow. Man.
But how do you screen for that? How do you screen for like maturity levels to an audience? Like you just don't really think through that right in the beginning. So those were, oh God, those were just cataclysmic like disasters, but then we survived. Like,
what do you mean? What's an HR violation that somebody would say?
Oh, anything from like sexist remarks to, getting drunk and then making a move on a married couple's, like, it was just like, oh my God, like there was some, I shouldn't even be saying a lot of this, but it was so like, it was bad.
It's amazing how much sexism exists that people don't recognize and they think it's a truism. And if they feel comfortable, they finally will talk about it as if to say, we all agreed this is true, right? We're not supposed to say it, but now that we're friends, I can tell you. Like, I'll give you an example. I hired somebody to help me find guests. And I said, we need to have more female entrepreneurs, which is always an issue for us. And he said, well, aren't you afraid that people are not going to take the site seriously if you have female entrepreneurs on?
Oh, ouch.
And there's a lot of internal belief around that that comes through in that sentence. And I try also to just let people be themselves, to give them space to be open so that I can see where I could see issues like this.
Mm. Yeah,
but I'm still shocked. You kept on hiring. How did you guys get students?
Oh, man. So we did, I mean, we just marketed the hell out of it as best we could in all the different channels.
What was your marketing? What worked?
Oh God, it was so different in so many different geographies. I think that was one of the big lessons learned, was what might work in one city obviously doesn't work in another. That's, you know, I say that and it's like, no fucking shit. Like that's so obvious. But at the time I was like, well, this should just work. But with a combination of digital and offline, and the offline is an entire black box to me. I'm a total kind of digital native type of guy. So buying billboard advertising like around Metro Atlanta, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I don't know anything about that, but we had to figure it out. We had to figure out competitive pricing. We had to figure out how to print like huge, massively big like billboard ads. And then how do you track conversions? How do you track like 2 million people driving up 85 every day and like, you know, phone call, like, oh my God, I don't even know.
And you had to figure that out.
Yeah, we had to figure that out.
Why do you even try billboards? If you guys are such digital natives, why not go to digital where you can measure it all?
Because the people that we were attracting came from a lot of non-technical backgrounds. They're working in big corporate jobs downtown or around the city, or manufacturing. Like,
and they weren't on Facebook?
No, not as much as we thought. So, but you just have this huge artery, right, within like Atlanta, and literally I don't even know, something ridiculous, but the amount of people who go up and down that corridor, and you just, you find the right verbiage, and people start calling. And so what the one line that we tested eventually landed on kind of being our go-to, which really, really fucking worked, was life is too short for the wrong career. And how many times have you said that to yourself? Like, not maybe not in those words, but like that just resonates with most people. And you're just like, shit, you're right. Like, what is that?
How did you know that that was, what was your test to figure that out, to find out what the right verbiage was?
We just A, B, C, Z tested, right?
On billboards?
No, just kind of in local surveys. But I think we just had an intuition because, and probably means we just got lucky, but I think we just like, those are the questions that we kind of ask ourselves, right? Like, why do we continue to build new companies? Because our career is constantly evolving and we don't want to get bored and life is too short not to do fun, cool shit. So we like me, I think that'll resonate and ended up really working well.
And you had a phone number on the billboard?
We know it worked so well because a lot of our competitors would use the same verbiage.
Online, what worked for you guys?
Oh man. Our go-to was blogging. Actually, we were the model educational company that blogged religiously every single day, using our students as content generators for stories. We did some video, but we were just ruthless about blogging. And that's really came from my background.
Yeah, you know what? I looked yesterday, you blogged. The day before, you blogged on your personal website, which
I've been blogging every single day for 17 years.
17 years, never missed a single day.
Nope.
All on your site. Why do you do that?
I started before like CMSs existed. So I was uploading HTML files, like, and it was just developer notes, you know, really shitty. It's extremely immature, like stuff around like the software that I was building. Eventually snowballed, of course, to the obvious next thing, which was my girlfriend at the time said I need to sign up for Zanga back in like 2002 because she was like, you should stop uploading via FTP or whatever that is. Like, just use this because I'm on it. I was like, okay, fine. So she signed me up and I wrote my first like blog post on Zanga in like May of 2002. And then I was just like, I was hooked. I was like, I really enjoy disseminating information. And a little bit later, I realized that this was actually a deep form of therapy for me. I have like ADHD, I'm on the autistic spectrum. And so it's like my mind is racing about 1,000 miles a minute. And if you had met me like 2 decades ago, like we would not have been able to hold the conversation because I would be like unintelligible. But writing has forced me to slow down. It has forced me to actually craft the words in a linear way, into a coherent way. And it's been incredible form of therapy. And so I still do it today, every single day, because I'm trying to understand my world. I'm trying to understand who I am, how I fit, play in it, like what role I have, and how to be a dad, how to be a parent, how to be a husband, how to be an entrepreneur, how to be a CEO. And when I write it on that canvas, things actually start making sense.
And because you were able to write for yourself on your blog, you're saying that you're also able to blog for the company.
Well, it's just the mechanics of writing was easy. So obviously content different, but it was so easy at that point that I said that we can build a content machine around who we are as a company. And then we can use that as marketing material, obviously, in a variety of different forms. This ended up being like one of these largest pieces of data for the Fortune 500 that ultimately acquired us. They actually told us, took me aside in our acquisition talks and said, when we were looking to buy one of these like more progressive educational ed tech companies, we could not go anywhere and not interface or like bump into one of your blog posts. And that's why, how we knew that you were a competitive force within the space. So
that makes sense versus seeing the ads everywhere. Actually, yeah. People don't see ads everywhere anymore because it's going to be so targeted that they may not come across it. But there's something about content creation that is ubiquitous. Yeah. You know what? This is actually a good time for me to say, anyone out there who wants to blog on their own site, and what John does is he puts it on his own site. It's john.do, but also on Medium. I like that you, why do you put it on your own site if instead of just moving over to Medium? Medium's become really popular. Or Facebook. Why do you do that, John?
Why do I do my own?
Yeah.
Because Medium, as much as I love Ev Williams, like, he's a history of ditching his projects. So, and that's not a hit against Ev, that's more of a hit against just hosted, like stuff that you don't own is just not a good idea. But using systems like HostGator or other like hosted platforms where you can own your own content, like on a WordPress blog, like that's you fucking eternal. So you should use it.
Yeah, Medium just changed the rules about how they handle domain mapping.
Oh, exactly. They got rid of it, which is like, that spells the end of like, these Fortune 500 companies have dedicated their entire publications to Medium and they kill the... That's weird. Anyway, go ahead.
And that's one of the challenges about publishing on other platforms. If you're like John or want to be like John and just experiment with publishing on a regular basis as a way of thinking things through, as a way of building your audience, as a way of building your reputation, as a way of practicing to create content without the pressure of having to sell anything, blogging is still a thing. Here's what you do. Just go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. You're going to get a super low price. And I would actually urge you to get that Medium package that they have on HostGator.com/Mixergy. Because that's going to give you unlimited domains. And I could see, where was that? Look at all the different domains you've had. CTOblog.com still points over now to John.do, right? HumanError.com, another one of your sites. JohnSaddington.com.
Where the hell are you getting these, like, you shouldn't be snooping. That's bad.
I do a hell of a lot of research. The thing is, a lot of people who are great creators have experimented with either different shades of the same idea or different ideas completely before settling on the one that works. And if you go with HostGator's, what they call the Medium plan, it's called the baby plan there, they're going to give you unlimited domains, which means you're going to get to experiment with a bunch of different ideas. And if they don't work out, you can always kill them and start with something new. I love the idea of endless creation on a path of finding a thing that makes the most sense. I love the idea of endless publishing. I've been doing it here on Mixergy through interviews. I think you need to find your outlet. And if it's going to be HostGator, go to HostGator.com/Mixergy where you'll give me some credit. And I appreciate you for doing it. You're supporting independent media, as my friend, as my friend says. And you're also going to be getting yourself a really good deal on that URL. HostGator.com/Mixergy. Jason Calacanis. I like how I talked to him about that in my interview with him. Why do you say support independent media? Who gives a rip? I don't know that my audience does. He said people do. I thought, all right. All right. Let's get into the sale. I see what you've built up. I see how you got your customers. I see how you were figuring out the team and the curriculum. The sale. How did it come about?
So I think one of the catalysts was General Assembly had just hired a fairly well-known CFO, which is a clear signal generally that you're looking into IPO. Also Kaplan, another Fortune, 500 company, Fortune 1000 company had just purchased, Dev Bootcamp. I hope I get that right. Out of Chicago. And so clearly there is a land grab for these upstart education boot camps. And so the larger corporate M&As obviously were going fishing. And as I mentioned, they found us. And so you begin the long, incredibly arduous sequence of corporate M&A, which ends up like taking longer than you fucking have patience for. And so I think the process end to end, God, almost a year, which is so fucking ridiculous how long that took. But, and so, yeah, we ended up, selling to, Apollo Global, and, that's the public company, and they hold a number of different investments. The one that people would most recognize is, University of Phoenix.
They own the University of Phoenix now. I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. And so they were seeing that these coding schools were becoming big. They thought, let's get into it. And it took a year. Why a year?
Because corporate M&A blows. And there's so many decision makers within that larger decision that just takes a fuck ton of time to get everyone in the fucking room. Like, I swear to God. But yeah, so we walked through it and continued
to sell.
So I've answered this question a number of different times. I think I've honed it in a way which is respectful to my co-founders. And there's nothing like actually negative, but I want to be fair and accurate. So I think this is the first time I've actually done it in a record though. So, or like on a podcast. So if you're listening, Eric Mason, Peter, forgive me for getting this wrong. So like anything, it's all situational, right? And everyone's motivated by different things and life kind of gets in the way. I think there were a number of issues for each co-founder, but one in particular, his wife had just received a very fair, super amazing offer, I believe, to go teach in a very, very, very small subsector of an industry at Oxford College. So like life-changing opportunity, like once in a lifetime opportunity. So I think that was a major catalyst for him saying, like, I just need liquidity. Another one had just had his first child and his wife wanted to quit her job, and totally makes sense. Totally empathetic of that as a father. So, you know, he needs liquidity. And one of them also, I believe his wife also wanted to stop working, and they have like, God, they have a huge brood, like 5 or 6 kids, right? And they needed liquidity. So that kind of left me at a point where I was like, well, I don't really need liquidity. I actually really, really like this company, but I wasn't getting along with a number of the decisions that had been made around this time. And so it made sense to sell. I think I did that as fair as possible without naming names.
Okay. So that makes sense.
So everyone had very legitimate reasons. I think there have been times where, just to be honest, at times where I felt like I was voted off the island, and that just happens.
What do you mean? Why do you think you were voted off the island? What was it about you?
I have worked for some of the largest companies in the world, like Dell, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, Fox, News Corp, right? Big, big Fortune 50, Dow 30 companies, right? And I fucking hated it. I hated it so much. And that's why I left. That's why I started building companies for myself. So I vowed like to never take another corporate job. And so selling to a Fortune 500 company, I think they were like number 320 in the Fortune 500 lister at the time, like huge company, right? I was like, that's the last fun thing I want to ever do in my life. And go work for the man. Like, no, you can't pay me enough to do that. It's
in
just
fact,
so
you left soon after.
Yes.
You gave up money for that, right?
I left actually almost immediately. I had no retention. I was like, fuck
it. I see. Look at this. According to my notes, you left so fast you didn't even get the retention bonus that they were offering you and the three co-founders got.
There was a lot of money on the table, for sure. The other three stuck around until the closure. I left immediately.
How much money did you get from the sale?
$23 million.
For the whole sale and then your share of that?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly how it was breaking down. Yeah.
But we're talking, you know, your share was what?
I don't feel comfortable sharing that.
Okay. But over 2 million, we can say.
That's probably a good guess. But okay. I would say for like, for the amount of time spent, which we'd gone from prototype to sale within like essentially 18, 20 months. It was a decent payday, I would say. There was a lot of heartache though. So
wait, you can say over 2 million, right?
Yeah, fine.
Okay. So over 2 million, I'm not going to just keep plowing along with that and go over 3, over 4, whatever, but it's significant for a couple of years of your life for a person who was so out of money that you were worried about your wife divorcing you at one point, right?
I still worry about her divorcing me. Let's be honest. No, just kidding.
But not about money issues, right? Wasn't that, why didn't that feel so good to you? Why didn't that feel like, you know what? I can finally catch my breath. The last time we talked about all the different companies you started. They were phenomenal ideas, phenomenal execution, and still you weren't financially well off. Why didn't this feel good to you financially?
Because I think for a number of different reasons. I think the first was I really, really liked that company. And we had really done some incredible work and we had changed a lot of people's lives. I played all my chips. And when I say that, I meant that I cashed in pretty much the most important things in my life, which were my relationships to make that happen. Two very obvious examples. One, I hired my maid of honor in my wedding to be an executive and leader at one of my campuses. I've known that gal for now 17 years. She's one of my best friends. Like, that was risky, right? I hired my wife's longest term friend from Augusta, Georgia, as one of my leaders within one of my other campuses in Atlanta. That is risky, right? To hire like these long-standing relationships on kind of type of this endeavor, but I cashed all those chips. One of those relationships survived. The other has not. And that, like, that tears me up. And that makes me desperately sad. And that was the cost. You know, in general, like at a high level, just, I think a gross misunderstanding. And that's all I want to say about that. And I'm just really sad that it hasn't recovered.
Do you think, have you ever tried to reach out to her?
Nope. Cause I think I'm right.
You think she'd be open to it?
I don't think so. I don't think she's the type of person to do that. But at the time, like, that she made some decisions that she felt was right. And I made some decisions that I felt was right. And we can't both be right.
On our upcoming monthly interview series, would you be willing to let her come on if she was open to doing it?
Oh my God. Ooh. Damn. I'd actually have to ask my wife about that, because that would be important to her.
Okay. Why did the company close? There's a New York Times article from 2017 about it. It's, look at this headline.
Oh, geez.
Look at the headline now.
Is it inflammatory?
As coding boot camps close, the field faces a reality check. And so I went into it going, let's see what the reality check is. I actually don't see a clear understanding from this article about what the reality check is at all. The closest I can come to is the price is really high. The boot camps were growing so fast that they couldn't build relationships with local businesses who were going to hire their graduates enough. And as a result, the thing collapsed. But those are solvable problems. Why do you think these businesses closed?
Because a business is really hard to manage. I think you can oftentimes, I think there are a lot of false positives. Like all of what you just enumerated were categorically untrue for our company, clearly. But
the price was not too high, the relationships high, with businesses.
Nope. Like all of that was actually amazing. Now we may be an anomaly and we were one of the few companies that get acquired in the space, but that was not true. Like we knew a lot of people in the space as being one of the largest code school in the world at the time. Mm-hmm. Like we knew every player and we had relationships with all of the senior leaders. So there was a lot of things going really well, but building a company, Andrew, as you know, like that's a very different skill set. And running a company operationally well is really hard.
But you know who could do it well is a company like Apollo. They're great at this stuff. They're businesses that do this.
You would think, but
so what parts do? We don't have to talk specifically about Iron Yard, and you don't have any deep insights into what happened at the company because you left. So it's all your understanding of the industry that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Why do you think these businesses failed? What's the one part that was especially painful, or what are the multiple parts that weren't easy to manage and as a result, dev bootcamp started to close?
Yeah. So I think it ties into what I've ever mentioned. Like running a company is difficult. It's not actually about the education space. It's just running in a company, any company for that matter, operationally well, managing P&L, managing hires, hiring, firing, like the whole kit and caboodle. It's really fucking hard. It's really fucking hard to do. And in a like super happy time where customers are like knocking down your doorstep, they still like struggle to build a functional company. And so a lot of the people I would say in the space, although perhaps had an education background, which many of them did, which is why they were in the space, did not have a clue how to run a company. And because of their lack of experience building a company or even raising capital or debt, like whatever, however they try to finance, like that's a very rare skill set. And to jump into a new type of industry, a new type of business model, without having experience building a business beforehand, like most of these companies were just, they were, the founders were vastly too immature.
But they were acquired by companies that could, like I'm thinking about which was it? The one that Kaplan bought out, wasn't Dev Bootcamp. It Dev Bootcamp or something?
Yeah, Dev Bootcamp. I think
DevBootcamp.com is now a dead site. Kaplan knows how to run schools across the world.
You would think. Right? You would think.
But you're saying this is just an especially tough group of students and teachers to manage.
Well, so I think it's important, like, and I think a lot of your listeners are probably business savvy, but and they would already know this, but most M&As like ultimately fail. I think it's something like paltry, right? Like, mm-hmm. like 9 out of 10 corporate M&As like ultimately fail. And so statistically you have a very low margin of success. But then I think you also add this very, very like challenging philosophical difference between like the Kaplans of the world, the Apollo Globals of the world, the University of Phoenix of the world, which are commercially oriented, right around profit motive. And most of the companies within the space, at least in the beginning, were founded on much different like auspices, right? So they were founded on more of like a dream of a better future outside of commercial exploitation. And so when you combine these two very different philosophical worlds, like no one agrees. And that was a big problem with the Iron Yard and even our acquisition and conversation is like, will you treat our staff right? Will you treat our, you know, customers right? Will you not try to fucking upsell them onto a next course, like right after they graduate? Like, right. Yes, 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 yes. Lies, 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 lies. And so that's just, you know, they're driven by something entirely different.
Didn't your co-founders go on to create Triangle Code School?
I believe the three are still, I believe the three are working together. I actually have a phone call with Peter Barr tomorrow.
Is it weird that they did include you? Or you just were done and ready to move on?
No, I wouldn't work with, yeah.
Because?
It's very rare. I've never worked with a previous co-founder, except for, I've worked with previous investors though. That's really good.
But once you're done with a relationship, you're ready to move on.
I think for a number of different reasons, but I think I don't know. Like, that's a really great question. I don't know. I really asked myself why, because there are some really great people I've worked with in the past that I'm like, goddamn, like I would work with that again. But I think timing is a huge part of building a company, and you just don't serendipitously like have the same timing.
You also seem to have like an ADD around business. Like where was that site? There it is. John.do/VC is the most interesting page to me on your site because it's like a history of you. That? Sorry? That's your lineup of all these businesses that you've started, that you've been a part of. And
oh my God. Yes, right. My curriculum vitae, yeah.
Yeah. John.do/VC.
I'm pretty honest, because don't I go all the way back to like my time at like being a working at Panera Bread? Yeah, I do.
Let me see if you go.
I go all the way back to like being a pizza cashier, a Publix bag boy. I worked at FedEx Kinko's for a while. FedEx no longer exists.
Right.
Yeah, I try to be as transparent as I possibly can.
Panera Bread. Prep cook. Pac-Mail, you worked as a cashier and you learned that people would try to ship anything and everything and they will ask you to do it for free. You worked at Boar's Head Deli in the meat department. I prepped, cut, and served deli meat to customers. There was a keg with free beer available to customers. Our job was to memorize faces and make sure that repeat customers would not come in, drink the beer, and then leave back a few hours later. I made $8 an hour, which was amazing. All right.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for doing this. The website where people should go is what?
I guess yen.io is what I'm currently working on.
Yen.io. Actually, what is the what's it called? The Patreon. I think people should go check out your Patreon page. It's patreon.com/pub. And the reason that I'd recommend that is, in addition to yen.io, which is the new thing, and you just will have one button that you can press to caught up on what he's doing with cryptocurrency.
We're onboarding our alpha customers this weekend, though.
You what? You're onboarding the alpha customers.
Real customers, real users, Saturday.
I just really like the thought process behind the Patreon, how the Patreon explains what you guys are doing. And anyway, wow. You were saying you're onboarding new people.
Yeah, that's probably why I'm so stressed.
Are you up for doing this as like an ongoing thing? Every month we'll schedule something out.
I think as long as people are somewhat entertained, then yeah, like this is kind of fun.
All right. Let's have people ask for it. If you're interested, guys, you know, my email address, it's contact@mixergy.com. The whole team will get to see it. So they'll all know why.
Be honest, because you know, you shouldn't waste his time or mine.
Yeah. It's gotta be, yeah. Be honest, really. If it's just like, hey, Andrew, you should do it. The reason I want to do it is I like to get deep with entrepreneurs. My big disappointment with Mixergy is that not enough entrepreneurs will get deep with me. Not enough entrepreneurs.
Why? Like there's very few things to hide.
You know what though? The founder of drips.com was just on with me. He is, he's a guy who talked about how in the early days, what inspired him was seeing someone's spam operation. It was just a bunch of computers. He's someone who talked about how, he was in the lead gen business, all the type of stuff that people are wishy-washy about and are afraid to talk about. He talked about it. I think it makes him a more interesting entrepreneur. It shows his hustle and it makes me care more about his story. What I didn't get enough with him was like about his personal life. I don't think enough entrepreneurs are willing to go there. You are. I'd love to do more with you. Let's let people let me know. And I also want to tell everyone, if you're interested in getting office space, John went for one of the competing office space companies. One of the things that draws people in is got free beer, free outdoor. You know what happens? The free beer means that people are sitting around drinking freaking beer all day, becoming a little bit alcoholic. And as a result, they don't get work done. It really demos well. Hey, check us out. Really cool looking environment. Guess what? The cool looking environment is not going to get you to do work. Hey, get this. We have free beer on tap. Guess what? Beer doesn't fucking get you to work. Coffee does. I love that they have free coffee here, free tea here, and that I don't have to pay for it all day and my guests get it. If they offered free beer, would I be excited about it? No freaking way. It's a distraction. I have whiskey over here if I need it. You could bring it in. You could put it in the fridge if you need it. I don't want it to be too readily available. I want us to be office space that gets you to work. That's why I freaking love Regis. I don't think they're going to sponsor me again. I think that I'm not their kind of person. They want more of they don't want to, some of the things that I've said, I don't think they're really happy about. They've actually asked Ari to edit, to give them an edited copy of all of my ads for them. I have a feeling that they're not even going to want me to be in their office. No, they're going to want me to be in their office. Let's be honest. They want my money as a renter. I don't think that they like that I talk about their competitors with beer. I don't think they like that they use the word fuck in relationship to them. I fucking love you, Regis. sorry to see you go. They already sponsored once before and they
strange limitation.
Wash our hands of Andrew.
Regis, come on now.
Ads from him, and then they came back. So who knows? Maybe there's a chance. Regis.com/Mixergy. Really, even if they stop sponsoring me, guys, go check out Regis. Have them give you a tour of at least 3 offices by them and try it out. You're going to see how much more productive you can be. And I want to thank my hosting company that will actually put up with a lot of my bullshit and smile about it. It's called hostgator.com/Mixergy, and I'm grateful to them for doing this. John, you were saying something. I'll give you the last word.
Oh, no, I just, Regis, what the fuck, man?
Thanks for doing this. Bye.
Bye, man.
Bye, everyone.